Good afternoon and a hearty hello to you from sunny downtown Philadelphia. Welcome to the Live Printing Impressions webinar, M&A 2013, The Rules of Engagement, sponsored by Consolidated Graphics. This is the second of a two-part series called Art of the Deal, The Path to Completion. I'm Eric Hegel, Senior Editor of Printing Impressions and the host of today's event. The purpose of this webinar is to walk you down the road to a successful transaction and outline the steps you can take to maximize the return on your business. From your point of view, it's essential to craft a deal that will protect yourself, your employees, customers, and that lifelong investment. Today's presentation will provide an overview of the considerations you should keep in mind as closing day approaches. Now, before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions during at the end of the hour. You can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets and bells and whistles on this console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. And now to discuss printing industry transactions in 2013, we have the distinct pleasure of bringing you two true M&A printing industry icons. Yes, we're talking about Joe Davis, Chairman and CEO of Houston-based Consolidated Graphics, and Jim Cohen, Executive Vice President of Mergers and Acquisitions for Consolidated Graphics. Gentlemen, on behalf of Printing Impressions, I'd like to thank you for taking time out from your busy schedule to share some of the finer points of printing industry mergers and acquisitions. And also, I believe for those who might not have been with us the first time, if you can give us a quick backgrounder on Consolidated Graphics. I'll pass it on to you, gentlemen.
Okay. Thank you, Eric. I'm Joe Davis, Chairman CEO of Consolidated Graphics. I have with me Jim Cohen, Executive Vice President, Mergers and Acquisitions. We're delighted to have you with us today. First, I'll give you a little bit of background about Consolidated Graphics. I founded the company in 1985. We've been in the acquisition business since then. Today, as you see from the map, I believe there's a map coming up. We have 70 locations in 27 states, Toronto, Prague, and Jiro, Japan. A little bit more about what we do. First of all, the general commercial printing business is a large business. We think that we focus only on the $45 billion piece of a much larger industry. And this is a very highly fragmented piece of business, our industry. We think that we have about 2% of the U.S. general commercial printing business. Other public companies maybe have as much as 3%, but most of the printing business is owned and controlled by local independent operators. Our strategy, certainly I said we had 70 companies. We're both sheet-fed, web, digital, large and grand format. We have over 500 custom web-to-print solutions, where we do mailing and fulfillment. In fact, we are the world's largest and most advanced digital printer. With 250 high-end digital presses. And digital comprises about 19% of our total sales to date. We offer a web-to-print solution that streamlines print production and management process to lower the total cost of ownership. We have 442 active sites, 400,700 users. And on those sites, we have 151,243 products. One of the things we're really proud of in our business is the leadership development program, and this is particularly important as you get into more and more technology. We have 550 people in that program that we've recruited from the college campus, and Well, of that, 161 are graduates of the program. It's now a two-year program. We have 26 of these graduates are operating company presidents. So a third of our company presidents are graduates of this program. And, you know, we've had this program going for over 20 years. It's gotten a lot larger as we've gotten larger. Well, we talked about in our first webinar, what makes a company attractive, critical path to selling, do I tell my employees, types of buyers, impact of technology, and how does a buyer value a company that wants to acquire it. So those particular topics, we're not going to, you know.
They're available on the first webinar, which Eric, I believe, is still available online, correct?
It is
That's
available
correct.
Online. The last time we talked about what makes a company attractive. Well, I keep it pretty simple. I say I look for good companies with good management, good employees, and good customers. You know, the potential to grow the company is important to me. The reputation of that company in the marketplace is very important. And certainly the cultural fit is a big, big piece of a successful company for us. What kind of companies do we like to buy? We like to buy anything that, you know, we're currently involved in, like digital, sheet-fed, web fulfillment, mailing, grand format, temporary point of sale. And people ask me, is there any size company you look for? We don't really have any minimum or any maximum. Our largest company was PBM in Durham, North Carolina, at $135 million revenue that we purchased about 5 years ago. And then people say, "Was it is my company profitable enough or not profitable?" We don't really have any rules about that. We buy the best companies in our industry, but, you know, periodically some of those happen to be distressed for various reasons. So I would say do not assume that a buyer will not be interested in acquiring your business just because you've had some, you know, bad financial problems. We've all had those over at various times in our career. And we like to be able to see how we might contribute to certainly fixing that. We're not in the business to not be profitable. So, but I would say we look at, Jim and I look at a lot of different companies from various, you know, aspects of the printing business and whether they're profitable or not, or how much debt they have really doesn't have much to do with it. So with that, Jim.
Okay. Thanks, Joe. So we thought now what would be interesting and of use to everybody would be to just, as an example, you know, we recognize we're but one buyer in the industry, but I think it might be helpful to see what kind of things we look for at the very earliest stage. And we look at hundreds of deals every year. And so what we try to do is streamline this process up front so that it's not too burdensome on the potential sellers. So the first thing we do is sign a confidentiality agreement, and what we ask for is financial statements for the first 3 years. So that would include your income statement and your balance sheet. And the question is, you know, what are we looking at? It's the same kinds of things you look at. You know, what is the revenue? How is the revenue growing? Is it growing along with profitability? What does the balance sheet look like? You know, what are the values of the equipment on the balance sheet? Is there goodwill on the balance sheet? What is stockholders' equity? You know, is there sufficient working capital to operate the business? These are the kinds of things that you look at. We look at the same kinds of things. On the equipment, we like to ask for, at least with respect to the presses, what is the age of the press, the make and the model, how many impressions are on the press. We certainly look at that as a gauge to try and understand what kind of CapEx we as a buyer would have to make in the near term. Then, of course, we look at the debt, obviously, and that includes capital leases. People ask, is it good, bad, you know, whether I have debt or not. You know, sometimes somebody will tell me, we have no debt, isn't that great? Well, you know, that's good, but having debt isn't necessarily bad. And obviously you don't want to have too much debt relative to your book equity, but that's kind of common sense, and that's the way you would look at your own balance sheet as well. So what happens in our process, at least, and I can't speak for every buyer, obviously, but what we do is I take this information and I go in and I sit down with Joe and we review it. If we determine there's a sufficient threshold of interest, then the next thing we do before we even discuss valuation is go visit the company. And that's because nobody can really value a business without seeing it, without getting to know the owners and the management and getting to really assess the cultural fit. I mean, what Joe says and what we really believe is that, you know, the financial analysis is kind of half the equation. The other half is cultural fit. It's very important that the companies we buy fit in with our culture and are able to cross-sell across our network. A few of the other things we look at, obviously the ownership structure, who owns the company, is it a C-corp, is it an S-corp? These days, most every business is an S-corp or an LLC, and there are usually no issues associated with that. How big is the company, meaning how many employees do you have relative to your revenue? We look at the real estate because obviously if we buy a company, we want to make sure that we don't have to move it anytime soon. So typically we're looking to enter into long-term leases. And that's usually good for the sellers as well because the way, at least with most companies we've bought, not all, the real estate tends to be held outside the company by a related party. And so that enables the owners to get a long-term annuity on the business. And we often prefer to buy the real estate if it's possible, but a lot of times the owners, if they want to enter into a lease with us, we're happy to do that. So the other thing is at this early stage, we don't ask for a customer list. We recognize that's a very sensitive topic. We obviously look at hundreds of companies. We don't buy hundreds of companies. We don't want to make anybody uncomfortable, and we don't need to see that information. But what is interesting to look at is what industries are they in? You know, are they industries that are growing? And then obviously, is there a concentration issue? You know, is one of your customers 40% of your business or, you know, that's relevant, although that hasn't scared us away. We're a big enough company. We can afford to take some customer concentration risk. Then union contracts. You know, we do own some union companies, and that does not scare us. So we certainly like to review union companies. But the issue there really is, for those of you that may be union, the big issue is the pensions that are underfunded, and so we'd want to look at that information. A lot of companies don't necessarily have a pension withdrawal liability, but some do. If you do, we like to try and understand what that is. And then the other thing we ask for is print samples, just to get a sense of the kind of work you do. And then finally, marketing collateral. So to see how you present yourselves to your customers, that's one of the fastest ways that we can get up to speed on your business. So the next topic is really structure of transactions, and I'll try and keep it at a relatively high level so I don't bore anybody. But when people talk about how you buy a company, there's always the discussion of asset purchase versus stock purchase. I think there's a misconception in the industry when people refer to asset purchases, they're used to seeing that in the context of distressed acquisitions where somebody, let's say, only buys assets and doesn't buy any liabilities. But an asset purchase is actually a legal structure whereby you can buy all the assets and assume all the liabilities on the balance sheet, which is what we do. The reason why a buyer would prefer an asset purchase over a stock purchase is very simple. It's because you can step up the basis in the assets that you purchase when you do an asset purchase, and you can't do that for a stock purchase. Also, in an asset purchase, you can deduct goodwill for tax purposes if there is goodwill created in the purchase. And so those are of economic significance to any buyer. And so what you'll find is most buyers don't have any issue doing an asset purchase because, again, most are LLCs or S-corps. It's really only when someone's a C-corp that they have a concern and would prefer a stock purchase because that's where they would potentially be subject to double taxation. But that happens very, very infrequently. And we can work with either, obviously. We've done both. Then there's the issue of how much to sell. So for us, we have a very simple, straightforward approach. We buy 100%. We pay all cash at closing. Not every buyer does that. Obviously, certain buyers don't pay 100% for different reasons. Sometimes they, for example, financial buyers will say, we want you to, quote, roll some of your equity, meaning keep 20%. And part of the reason they do that is so they don't have to put in as much equity. Part of the reason they do that is so that they can have the seller have some skin in the game. And obviously the way they sell it to the sellers, too, is that, hey, you can participate in our upside. The issue with that, of course, is you know, you can participate in the upside, but you don't control the company anymore, so you do have some risk with that. It's not to say one way is better than the other. It really totally depends on the seller and what the seller's appetite for risk is. Again, same issue with sometimes you see a buyer requiring that a note be part of the transaction. Typically, when I see that, I think that just means they don't have enough cash to finance the deal. We typically don't like to do that. Then the role of equity debt, mezzanine debt, and implications of this. So when we buy a company, we pay all cash. It's very simple. But there are a lot of transactions you read about in the press where somebody is, let's say, typically you see it with a financial buyer, where they obviously put in as little equity as you can put in, and then you raise some senior debt, and then you also raise what's called mezzanine debt, which is basically in between, and it's high interest with some warrants typically. And when you look at a structure like that, it sounds complicated. Doesn't mean, you know, the deal is any worse or better than a cash deal, but what you have to consider when you go through the process of doing that, a lot of times it makes the transaction, at least from my perspective, more risky, because what that means is you don't just have the buyer coming in and doing due diligence. Like when we do a transaction, we do the due diligence all ourselves, all internally. We don't need approval from our bank. But where somebody is raising senior debt and subordinated debt, they typically get those lenders involved in the due diligence process, and typically it just may extend your due diligence phase, and it may also put it at risk because they may find issues that they don't necessarily agree with one another on. So that's something I would say you should just be aware of. And then there's finally the issue of mergers. You know, what's a merger versus an acquisition? Typically, when I think of a merger in our industry, it's two companies coming together and essentially swapping each other's stock so that they really, there's no cash in the transaction. It tends to be more common in more distressed situations where it's more of a defensive transaction. So two companies in a local market might decide that's the best way to move forward. And again, that can be good and it can be bad. It just depends. It's, really, do you want to take somebody else's equity? That means, you know, you don't look at that lightly. You're essentially buying some of their company and they're buying some of your company. So both parties need to do due diligence. And then you need to make sure when you're done with the transaction that you have the control issues worked out. Who is actually running the company? Typically, if it's a 50-50 deal, that's tricky. Just things to consider. Also, are you going to move one facility into another? Our experience has been if you do that and you pick up a company that's doing well and you move it, it's a lot of risk you're taking on and a lot of expense that might not have the return you expect. Okay, so this next topic, I'll just, Joe, you can chime in if you want, but I'll just continue here. How does a seller get on the buyer's radar? A lot of different ways. From our perspective, we do a lot of the sourcing ourselves internally. I have a lengthy database that I constantly update, and we try to stay abreast of who's who in the industry. But there are times when you may be interested in having, putting your company up for sale, and you're wondering, how do I get someone to make me an offer? One way, which is the most obvious, is to pick up the phone and call buyers you know of. Now, obviously, this works better with a larger company like us or other public companies you may be aware of, rather than just calling the person down the street. Sometimes people ask, does that make them seem desperate? No, not at all. I think as an owner of a business, you always have to evaluate your alternatives. And just because you pick up the phone and ask somebody to say, hey, I'm curious what if you'd have any interest in our business, it doesn't mean you're going to sell the business. It means you're going to have a discussion and see what we think it's worth or what a buyer thinks it's worth. How do you do this and preserve confidentiality? This is a fair question. So, if you were to pick up the phone and call one of your competitors, that's a questionable move because then, of course, they know, oh, maybe this company's for sale. If you call a larger public company like ourselves with a separate headquarters, we have 70 companies. We don't share any information with our subsidiary operating company, so they have no idea who we're talking to. So if you call into headquarters, you talk to me or you talk to Joe, there's no issue on confidentiality. It's obviously preserved. But where you're dealing with someone in your local market, it becomes a little trickier. The other way is the buyer contacts you directly. I'd say 95% of the transactions we've done in the last 10 years have been this way, where we've reached out to people and just said, hey, are you interested? It's like, you know, our version of cold calling and direct mail. The other way, which is certainly the most traditional way when you are an owner of a company looking to sell, is to hire a professional. And we, I think, talked about in the last session, we have no preference one way or the other. In some cases, it's very helpful to have, even from the buyer's perspective, to have an advisor involved on the seller side because it makes the transaction go more smoothly. So the question then is, what's the difference between a broker or a banker? They're really interchangeable terms, but it's important to realize that there is a spectrum of services that can be provided. For example, when people think of investment bankers, you're typically thinking of somebody who comes in and might charge you a retainer and prepare a lengthy memorandum on your business, come in and spend a month really understanding your company, and then what they'll do is go out and source potential buyers for you and then advise you along the way. A broker on the other end of the spectrum could be as simple as a finder, you know, somebody who says to you, hey, I know somebody who might be interested in your business. If they buy you, you pay me a fee, and they don't really provide a service, or they don't prepare a memorandum, and they don't advise you on the sale. So there's and in between both of those sides of the spectrum, there's you know, obviously all kinds of different folks who might be able to assist sellers, and that's something you as a seller can consider whether that's going to be of value to you or not. Again, we have no preference. We've certainly done transactions both ways. So in terms of a what are the risks associated with an auction, I mean, sometimes you see this in other industries and certainly in our industry too in certain periods where, you know, someone says, I want to hire me and I'll run an auction. Well, that is one way to get – and by auction, I mean a sales process where an advisor would come in and basically say, I'm going to contact X number of buyers. I'm going to have them come in and do due diligence, each give a bid, you know, and then work a process until you finally get down to the highest one. That is one way to achieve the highest sales price. In our industry, our experience has been that going through a public process like that, and I say public, it's still not technically public, but what happens is when an advisor reaches out to a wide spectrum of potential buyers, and in the last few years, certainly in our industry, they'd have to cast a net pretty far and wide to find several buyers for a potential company. It becomes quasi-public because you've got people who might be called and who, you know, invariably talk about these things. The other thing is in a process like that, it can take 6 months, and it's very disruptive to an owner's business. So, again, think about that. What we certainly participate in those if they occur. We also do what we call negotiated transactions, which is where, you know, we negotiate one-on-one as the buyer, one buyer, one seller. And there's a role, obviously, for the for any advisor in that situation as well. Next question, I think, would be if you hire an advisor or a broker, who pays the fee? That is the seller who pays the fee. That is the common practice. Retainer is also a common practice, and I think from the part I'm not an investment banker, but the reason why they ask for it is to make sure the seller's serious. You know, if it's just a success fee, I think that the banker, you might not get as good a quality as an investment banker because they typically won't want to invest the amount of time it takes to really accurately prepare a memorandum and advise you if it's purely based on a success fee, and they want to, because they might spend 4, 5, 6 months trying to sell your company, and then the seller says, "No, that's not high enough price. Sorry." That's kind of a worst case scenario for an investment banker, and also, of course, for the buyer who was involved in that process. So one way to make sure people have some skin in the game is to charge them a fee as they go along. I think I talked about this next point already about rolling equity. Next question is, how long does it take to sell my company? That process is really across the board. From our perspective, the part that can take longer is just the part of, hey, you know, do you want to have a conversation at all? Once we get the material and we look at it and we get to a letter of intent, it's a kind of a 6 to 8 week process for us. but that's because we handle it all internally. We don't need to raise money. We don't need to get approvals. It can extend for several months beyond that, depending on who your potential buyer is or if you're running an auction process. So there are a lot of different variables there. What should you watch out for and avoid? The most obvious thing I would say to be careful of when you're selling your company is what I would call kind of a phony letter of intent. And what I mean by that is we've seen it where in order to lock somebody up, and typically a letter of intent will always have a no-shop provision, which means once you sign it with a buyer, a potential buyer, you're not allowed to talk to other folks while that letter of intent is in effect. And sometimes we see situations where a buyer will spend time going through due diligence only to change the terms or increase the price. It's something we really never do, and we have a, you know, a 28-year-old track record of not doing that. So what I would advise, my advice for sellers is to avoid that situation, or even maybe they don't retrade you, but maybe they can't raise the financing that they said they could.
That's what I normally see. Let me see more of is somebody comes to a company, says, yes, I can pay you this price for it, whatever the price happens to be.
Right.
What that really means is they got to go out then and raise the money, sometimes the equity money as well as the debt money, or they're either going to maybe sometimes even try to sell it to somebody else. In the meantime, they make some money.
So you've effectively given them an option for no consideration.
Right, you give them an option to fool around with your company without any commitment on their part. So that's something I would really caution people to be careful about.
And the one way you can protect yourself, too, is one of the things we do, even before we sign an LOI, we say, hey, we've been doing this 28 years. You're welcome to talk to any of our previous sellers. And effectively, anyone who you're talking to should be willing to let you, you know, basically give you references, you know, other transactions they've done, just so you can make sure you don't find yourself in that situation, you know, 3, 4, 5 months down the road without a transaction being completed. Okay, the next question is, you know, and these are just questions we came up with, I think, with Eric, just thinking of a common question. So when, you know, are employees at risk?
Employees at risk, I'd like to address that. I've never had a situation where us buying a company became a real issue for employees. People are always worried about their salespeople in particular. Well, you know, if it's a sheet-fed shop, for instance, I think we have a lot more to offer to a salesperson to sell and make commissions on than just sheet-fed business. We've got inline finishing equipment. We've got web printing. All those things a salesperson can sell that's produced in another location and make more money. And technology. Most of the time we have technology that is a little bit more advanced than the companies we're buying. So I think it's always good for the employees and salespeople. And I've even had we don't normally go to a company and make a big announcement about it. You know, the guy who's running the company would tell his employees, and I wouldn't be there. But I remember one time in Sacramento, guy asked me, he said, I want you to make an announcement to my employees. Well, after we made the announcement, employees came up to me, a few of them, and said, you know what, I'm glad this is happening because I was concerned about the owner who was commuting 60 miles a day. If he was involved in any kind of accident en route to work or leaving work, then what would happen to this company? What would happen to our jobs? So, you know, employees have a lot of concerns that sometimes we're not aware of. But I thought that was a pretty interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
I was wondering, I was curious about something. Now, you're talking about discussing the issue with employees. Now, how does that work with when you're dealing with a union shop? Is there a certain point where you're kind of contractually obligated to say something, or does that not really hold true?
Well, we certainly had cases where we bought union shops, and most of the time we talk to the union ahead of time, whether it's required in the contract or not. I don't believe it's required
it's not,
in the contract, but we normally talk to the union to be sure they understand what's going on. And I'm pleased to say that we've gotten some very good receptions from the union. We bought EGT in Detroit, and the union there had given that company a 10% wage reduction because of the recession. And they weren't obligated to continue that under new owners. They were glad to see us there, and they continued the wage reduction after we bought the company. And I'm pleased to say that company has survived. It was in some financial distress before, and it's doing very, very well. So, yes, we prefer to always keep somebody like the union involved.
Even another example is when we bought the Hennigan Company, we went and made an announcement to the sort of the management team, and the management team went and made their own announcement to all the employees, and simultaneously with that, one of their employees went and made the kind of the union aware of the transaction and came back that same day and told us that the union was very excited about that because they knew us from the other companies we owned. We had a good relationship. And so they found out not because it was we were contractually obligated to tell them. But this, again, this is at the letter of intent stage when we did it, at least in the case of Hennigan. So there's no, it was not a, you know, a done deal at that point. But in the interest of being kind of transparent, we told them. So they were real happy about that.
And, you know, do I stay on or retire? This is, does an owner stay on or retire? First of all, I would say that we like to buy companies where the owner is going to stay on. Now, you know, I've always told my story about having bought a company, Mr. Wetzel, who was 95 years old. No, he didn't stay on. But he lives to be 105. He probably could have stayed on. But we did get a non-compete from him, I would say that. So we prefer management to continue and stay on. Now, if for some reason, you know, age or whatever, management says, well, I don't mind staying on. I'll stay on 6 months or a year or 2 days. We will see if we can work around that. And oftentimes we can.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the.
What would you say, though? When you look at it, it's actually surprising when you look at the demographics of the people who sell their companies to us. They're surprisingly young as well. I mean, and these are folks who, the way I couch it is, it's typically people who, for whatever reason, decide to take some of their chips off the table to diversify. And yet they're young enough that they certainly don't want to retire. They still want to be part of the business that they, you know, their own legacy that they created. And so then it becomes kind of a chapter two as part of a larger public company that's pretty interesting and exciting for them because now they have 70 peers that they can work with. And I think people are often surprised when they hear that you know, typically, you know, we're not buying companies from people in their 70s. They're typically they could be anywhere from 40 to, you know, to 60.
Or 30.
Sometimes. They could be younger, yeah. That's true. We do have some. So.
I guess one we miss are my customers at risk. One of the things that we follow that's a little bit different, I don't really go talk to customers. I think if customers have been doing business with your company and they've been paying their bills and they're repeat customers, there's some reason they like your company. Otherwise, as everybody knows, the printing business, they go down the street somewhere else. So, you know, there are other competitors in the marketplace that can serve them. So we don't really talk to customers ahead of time. Now, certainly after an announcement's made, customers become aware of it, and we want to make the salespeople aware of the benefits of being with our organization. And we have technology, we have other services we can offer. All those things. So I think generally it's very good for customers to be part of a large organization.
One thing that you should be aware of, though, is that, for example, not everyone has that, you know, same philosophy. So a lot of buyers, when they come in their due diligence process, they will say as part of their due diligence they want to speak to your top X percent of customers. And to me, as a seller, that becomes tricky because you haven't consummated any kind of transaction. You've got somebody potentially, you know, getting in the middle of your relationship, and there can be risks with that. The other thing, though, that I would say with customers is typically for us, what Joe said is certainly true, that If they like doing business with you before, they're gonna like it even more after. And why would they like it more? Well, typically, once we've bought a company, the only thing that would change would be we're a public company, so they can look at our financials. They can look at our balance sheet. They can see all the other capabilities we have. So it really only could be better for them. There's no downside. There's only upside. And particularly over the last 3 years or so during this recession, a lot of salespeople have come to recognize what an asset it is to have a strong balance sheet to sell. It's not something they typically even understood before, but believe me, they understand it today. So having the ability to make investments in equipment for your customers is something the customers certainly appreciate.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Jim, if I may ask a question. Now, talking about customers, in terms of your salespeople, if a lot of customers are concentrated in the basket of one salesperson, does that kind of throw up a red flag in terms of what a buyer should be aware of, that there's always that risk that if you lose that one superstar salesperson who has a lion's share of the sales percentage, that it could make for a bad deal in the end?
Well, I certainly think that's a good point, Eric. We certainly bought companies where you had a concentration of business in one salesperson. I think that generally it's safe to say that most customers do business with a company for reasons that are not just that salesperson. I mean, it takes a whole company to service that customer, not just that salesperson. Some salespeople have very, very strong relationships, but I would have to say that that salesperson is probably going to be better off as a part of our group than they are by themselves as a single company. So that really doesn't overly concern me. Certainly it makes a risk factor. No question. But if we're going to keep the pay the same, the service level the same, and offer more for that person to sell, it seems to me that that risk is somewhat low for us.
And it's been proven out, too. It's interesting, and this is something as a potential seller you should really think about, because I know as a seller they often worry, well, if I'm midstream in executing a transaction and one of my big salespeople leaves, does that mean my deal is now dead, or is the company worthless? We don't have a problem. We're not worried about that. As Joe said, we know that it's really better for the salespeople. They're going to stay. And I have one example of that with an acquisition we did several years ago where a salesperson, the owner of the company, came to me and said, hey, would you come speak to this person? It's our top sales guy. He wants to just have an audience, basically. He wasn't exactly sure what he wanted, but I went and met with them. Sometimes it's an ego thing. Sometimes they just want to seem, you know, essential to the transaction, because a lot of buyers will interview salespeople. We're not as concerned about it. Again, we don't want them to feel that it's a job interview, that some of them are going to be hired and some aren't. We're going to hire all of them. We're going to hire all the employees. But in this particular case, I went and met with the salesperson, and really what it came down to is he thought that he could extract some sort of deal for himself, meaning he was looking for what's called a retention agreement. He said, well, you're going to buy this company. You need me. Pay me X or Y over the next couple years so I stay. And our policy is certainly we are not worried about that. And I said to him, look, I can understand why you're asking that. I think that as an intelligent salesperson, you're going to recognize that the best thing you can do is stay, that we have every capability you have today you're going to have tomorrow, and in addition you're going to have 70 other companies with other capabilities that you can sell. And also, by the way, we invest. So I know who your customers are. We're willing to make investments to better service them. And so I left saying, no, we're not going to do that. And, you know, lo and behold, that salesperson stayed. And so that's been our experience time and time again over the last 28 years. And so that's why we don't really get overly concerned in due diligence with going to, quote, interview salespeople or due diligence the customer base, because we know they're going to stay. And I think that's something as a seller should think about, because other folks seem to be somewhat preoccupied with that. And it might be a relevant preoccupation, because, for example, if you're a financial buyer and you're looking at customers, this goes to my last bullet point. It's tied into this, which I didn't really plan, but why should you care how the acquisition is financed? Well, you should care. You know, for example, if you're sold to a financial buyer who, again, is their objective is to put as little equity in the deal and to basically raise senior debt and mezzanine debt, when a customer looks at, you know, is aware of that kind of a transaction, or even a salesperson, the salesperson knows that if it's owned by private equity, the company's for sale the day after it closes. So it's not a long-term play for them necessarily. The company could very well be over-leveraged, and a customer could look at that and say, oh, gosh, I don't see this company really. Our experience with private equity-owned companies is maybe they're not going to make the same investment in the business because they're busy, you know, paying down their debt as opposed to investing in new equipment. And so I'm not casting aspersions on private equity generally. I'm just saying these are considerations that you as seller should think about, because when we say it doesn't matter to a customer or a salesperson because it's only all good news, it's not always the case depending on who the buyer is. It really depends who your buyer is. So I think with that, we have finished, Eric, at least the questions we thought would be relevant, and we can certainly open it up for anybody's questions that they may have in the remaining time that we've got.
All right, Jim. I appreciate the information. Some good stuff here. Just to kind of put the people at ease, to give them, we had talked earlier in the webinar about how often, how it may look for a prospective seller to approach a prospective buyer. And now, roughly, without giving away trade secrets here, how often is Consolidated Graphics approached by a prospective seller?
How often are we approached by sellers?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's pretty – well, I would say it's not frequently, but it happens periodically, and it happens typically what I do – ever since I've gotten here, I try to send out some letters and direct mail or email, sort of my own low-tech direct mail campaign. And so I'll send a letter to some of my top prospects, and in response to that, I'll certainly get phone calls or emails. Other times I do just get called out of the blue. That's part of the reason why we like to do our own PR, which is really what this is too, which is to get the message out there that we are buying companies, and we welcome calls from sellers. So I would say it's, you know, it's fairly common. And like I said, 95% of the transactions we've done in the last 10 years have really come through either the results of these direct mail efforts or our own PR efforts.
Now, you talked earlier in the show about the having a company having debt and too much debt. I guess one question would be, is there a magic number or an acceptable amount of debt compared to book equity?
You know, the amount of debt a company has, it is what it is. But I don't think there's any, you know, certainly that if you're running your own company, you certainly have some guidelines. You don't want to get debt above a certain level, and your bank is going to try to prevent that. But if we're buying a company, I don't think there's any particular debt level we'd be concerned about. So sometimes with the economy like it is, your debt level's gotten rather high. And, you know, sometimes we can work with the bank or other financial institutions to maybe help solve that problem from an acquisition standpoint. Maybe they're willing to take a cut to how much they're owed. You know, if you've got a workout agreement with your bank, if the owner has a workout agreement with his bank, they're probably willing to do something if somebody comes forward with an offer to maybe cut that level. So the amount of debt really doesn't is not a deterrent to us.
Okay. One of the people in the audience wants to know, was there ever a time that you issued stock options to the seller instead of paying 100% cash?
In our earlier years, we issued stock to some sellers rather than cash. We were such active in the acquisition business that our debt lines were stressed and we issued some stock. Today in the printing business, our stock is trading at such a low level that from a capital standpoint, I'm really not too interested in doing that. I haven't done that in a number of years.
I mean, frankly, it's typically more interesting to the seller to be able to get all cash. Certainly in the early days, that's why a company like this went public, was to have a currency when it didn't have enough cash to basically make acquisitions. So we're kind of in the envious position today to be able to pay cash. So if somebody wants their stock, they certainly – the other thing is if you give someone stock, then you have issues of lockup periods and various other things, and then does it go up?
I am pleased to say, Eric, you've been following industry a long time and very knowledgeable. I am pleased to say that we issued stock to some people in the 90s, but it was freely tradable stock. They could sell it the next day. And people would call me and say, well, I've got your stock. What should I do with it? And I would say, what percent of your net worth does that represent? And I probably already knew the answer. And if it's a large percentage, I'd say I don't think I'd want, 90% of my net worth tied up in any one security. So I really, and it doesn't make any difference to me whether you keep it or sell it. And there's some people in the printing world today who have been very thankful that they got that advice from me, and they didn't have lockup periods where they couldn't sell the shares. Most of them are living in Florida or Arizona now.
All right, we have another question. I think I know the answer to this one, gentlemen, but one of our attendees would like to know, is there any particular region of the country that you are particularly focused on? Are you looking in the Northeast? Are you looking out West? What are you guys looking at right now?
Well, we actually look at all areas of the country looking for good companies. We're even looking at some operations outside the U.S. at the moment. So there's no particular area of the country that we're really focusing on. What I've found is that there are good printers and good businesses in all geographies.
Particularly now, I mean, if you look at our Eric, if you look at our map today, we're in or near every major metropolitan area. So, the issue really is geography is a relevant consideration, but it's not at the top of the list. We're really just looking for the best companies that we can find. So we've looked in some pretty remote places too, and if the company's doing well, we'll be interested in it if it's got good customers and everything else. So that's not the primary driver. Sometimes people think it is because they see our map, but it's really not.
How much competition exists between the companies that you acquire?
Well, in some locations we have 2, 3, 4, 5 companies in a metropolitan area, and they compete with each other, but they compete with about 15 other companies in an area too, like Washington, D.C., Baltimore. So what we really find is that each company has a somewhat of a specialty, so there's not as much overlap as you might think in the competition, but they compete with each other. But as I explained to somebody, I'd rather have 3 companies competing for the business than one. If you've got 5 other companies, 6 other companies competing with it, we got a better percentage chance of getting the business.
What I've noticed, though, that's interesting is that, and it probably makes sense when you look at the how large some of the markets are, but typically we look at a company that, and we often are evaluating acquisitions within markets where we have one or more companies. It's interesting to note that they typically don't really have a lot of overlap customer-wise. So there's not as much. Sometimes that's a concern of sellers. Well, you got a company down the street, and we'll look at it and we'll say, oh, we're not even doing business with these folks. So I'd say the one exception when we aren't competing, Joe, is certainly when we look at some national accounts and we have to respond to an RFQ or something, we handle that with a centrally out of Houston
right.
In terms of responding. And the reason why we do that is because, as you guys probably all know, responding to an RFQ, RFP is a major task. It's a major undertaking. a company like ours, no one company would want to spend the time or even be necessarily aware of every capability we have. So we do have some folks in Houston that will respond to those on behalf of all our companies.
And we wouldn't want a customer getting responses from three different companies of ours. And they don't, the major companies don't want that either. They want one consolidated graphics response that is served, and all the companies would service them.
One of our listeners wants to know. She's with a small company in the 750,000 sales range. Wants to know, how does that company find an appropriate buyer?
Well, you know, I think the ways we mentioned, you could hire an investment banker or a broker. You could call people directly who you think might be interested in your company. You could call us. You could call other people. And depending on circumstances, we might have an interest. I would say that 750,000 sales level, that's somewhat difficult to find a buyer many, many times. So you may be faced with looking at a local company or local somebody who wants to buy that company, maybe an employee.
Yeah, I think the popular misconception is that Consolidated Graphics only looks at companies in the $25 million range, but obviously you look for a lot of things factor into whether or not a company is a good fit for Consolidated Graphics. You mentioned cultural fit. Yeah, go ahead.
There you go. Cultural fit is very, very important. I would say that we have companies ranging from size from 4 million to a, you know, PBM at 120, 130 today. So we have some smaller companies, smaller operations. So we look at a lot of different things. But I think the cultural fit is probably the most important thing that there is. And what I really find in this business is that, you know, to be successful in this business, you got people who are very focused, hardworking, dedicated people, the owners as well as employees. And, you know, we visit some companies sometimes that people seem to be a little too, you know, pretty high flyers. And, you know, they're driving, living really high, you know, in relation to the size company. And the company's got a lot of debt. And, you know, sometimes those don't fit so well with us. So we're very focused on the printing business and taking care of our customers. And, you know, to be successful, if you see a successful company, you're going to find that they have a similar focus. And printing business is hard work. There's no question about that. And the owners have to be committed to having a successful business. If that means you're there 7 days a week, you know, that's what you have to do. And we have a lot of our presidents who, you know, are at their company 6-7 days a week, if necessary, if the volume is there, if the commitment's there, if the, you know, we have the customer deadlines. So this is a very engaging business, and one that you have to be fully committed to.
Someone would like to ask, after you acquire a company, how often do you change compensation plans? Do your existing companies all have different comp plans?
Well, our goal would be not to change a comp plan. Now, you know, over time, sometimes circumstances change. The nature of the industry changes. And so, certainly we've adjusted a few compensation plans in response to that. But generally, our goal is not to change compensation plans.
So for example, we get that question a lot with respect to commission plans, and it's a concern of sellers probably in the first or second meeting. And so, you know, if you looked at our 70 companies, we have 70 different commission plans because we don't change them. You know?
Somebody asked me if I want to see our standard plan recently.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we got 70 standard ones. But in the end, they're all very similar and pay a similar commission rate when you get right through it.
Okay. Another listener wants to know, would you typically pay more or less for a company that's being sold through an auction process managed by an investment banker?
I would say that we would offer the same price whether you called us directly or went through the investment bankers or whoever else. It really wouldn't have any impact on our price that we would offer.
Okay.
When we make an offer for a company, we've studied a lot of companies. So, investment bankers sometimes, they're pretty good salespeople when they're trying to get a job. They're going to tell you they can get more and they can do all this stuff. The fact is, today, for any sizable company, there are not too many people out there who are buying companies today. And they all have some judgment about what they want to pay for a company. So, we're going to pay a fair and reasonable price, and we're not going to be, negotiating too much on that.
Now, this is an interesting question. Have you ever done an acquisition that didn't work out in the end, and how was that resolved?
Unfortunately, we have done some acquisitions that we acquired the company for various reasons that worked out so well for us. We got a company today, a great little company in Kalamazoo, Michigan, Superior Color Graphics. It's a great company, still run by John Broussais. He and his brother ran it to start with. And Pharmacia and Upjohn, a big pharmaceutical company, was there in Kalamazoo, and they represented probably 60% of their business. And, the pharmaceutical business can be a rather nice business for the printing companies. And unfortunately, somebody bought Pharmacy at Upjohn and pulled that company out of Kalamazoo. You got a lot of vacant buildings there now where they were. But we downsized the company, certainly. It certainly doesn't have the revenue it had at one time. It doesn't have the profits it had at one time. And from an investment standpoint, I would say that it hadn't been, a great return on investment for us. But, we're still operating that company. John Broussais is the president. It's downsized, and I'm pleased to report that it's a profitable company. And John Broussais not only gets his compensation, but he's earned some incentive pay, and he earns that most every year. So, sometimes these things, that's a business risk you have to take sometimes.
And I think that's something that's unique about us in terms of when you look at how long we hold our companies. We're really in it for the duration. So, if a company has some bumps in the road, it's to be expected, And, I get calls probably every week from there are private equity firms that specialize in seeking divestment opportunities from larger public companies, that may have assets they consider, quote, non-core. Well, with us, we never have non-core assets because we only buy companies, we're in the, our sweet spot is commercial printing. Those are the kinds of companies we buy. If they underperform for whatever reason, we don't just flip them out. We keep them. And so we hold on to them and we improve their operations. So since I've been here, which has been about 8 years, never once have we even entertained any of those calls that I get. So I think that's a positive too if you're a seller, because what you want is a long-term owner, somebody who's in it for the long haul, who's going to preserve the legacy. And we recognize that particularly, you look at the last few years of the recession. The companies we bought in 2007 and 2006, you don't think that they had some big revenue drops in 08 and 09? They sure did. But those companies are still part of our family of companies. So I think that's a real positive.
All right. A real quick question. Do you see Consolidated Graphics building its portfolio of companies in the packaging side?
Well, I would say that we like the packaging business. And today we have about I would say $80 million of packaging type revenue. And we have one company, Hickory Printing Company, has a division in Greensboro that's, you know, completely dedicated company to packaging. We have others in Toronto that's packaging entirely, and a couple of others who have about 60% of their business is focused on packaging. So we like the packaging business, and that's one of those things we have from a strategic plan standpoint is to expand in that industry.
All right, gentlemen, I think that's about all the time we have for today. Now, be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. Parts 1 and 2 of this M&A series can be accessed via our PIAPIWorld.com website. If you would just take a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your screen next, we would be grateful. Your information will help to influence the webinars we bring to you in the future. And so, for Joe Davis and Jim Cohen of Consolidated Graphics, I'm Eric Hegel of Printing Impressions Magazine. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope to speak with you again real soon. So long, everybody.